On guard, Dr. Agarwal. David has thrown his stone.
Dr. Weir, in all the years that I've known and worked with you, this is the first time. I'm stunned. I don't know what to say. You finished 6 minutes early. Rajiv, your turn.
I don't have to do anything because Matt never talked about blood pressure. And he agreed with me that volume control is important. Now I can ask him this question: how do you think you will control volume and not improve blood pressure? If you're controlling volume, it's going to improve the blood pressure. So I think that you illustrated the point that it's really important to control volume, and that hopefully will control the blood pressure. He provided you great strategies for controlling dry weight, which was not just the dietary sodium restriction, but also paying attention to the dialysate sodium to achieve hemodynamic stability by increasing the duration of dialysis, frequent dialysis, and those are all important. There's one important study that he mentioned was the association of intradialytic hypertension. So as you remove fluid, your blood pressure actually goes up. It happens in about 10 to 20% of these people. And that condition is associated with increased mortality. And what we found in the DRIP trial, when we analyzed the data again, there were a small number of patients, about 20%, who had an increase in blood pressure while we remove fluid. Now, since they were participating in a randomized trial, they had further reduction in volume because we didn't pay attention to the intradialytic change. We were simply treating their blood pressures and we were reducing the dry weight. And it turns out the people who had an intradialytic hypertension, they had the greatest improvement in blood pressure. So intradialytic hypertension appears to be another sign of volume overload rather than being something which is activating simply the renin-angiotensin system. So you reduce their weight and they will improve further. Regarding the W-shaped or U-shaped relationship, I know it's a funny relationship that you see there. And the reason most likely it is because that we saw blood pressures that were elevated at home and we intervened. That's why we saw that there was a W. So those people who would otherwise have been at a high risk, we improved their blood pressure, and therefore they had a lower mortality. Again, you cannot draw cause and effect relationships with these, but it points out to an important role of home blood pressure monitoring in these patients. I think there are probably more similarities between how Matt and I think about this subject than differences, but I think he never addressed blood pressure. Thank you.
Okay, Matt, your turn.
Don't trip. Well, I didn't want to address blood pressure because I'm not really sure it's important. I certainly can't measure it in the dialysis unit and make sense of it. And I don't have 44-hour ABPM. I didn't mention blood pressure because I hate to say it. At least as I look at most of the data, it's probably not important. So I will show you what I think is important. Again, Dr. Agarwal, is this really? No, that's not what you want. So I showed you that graphic before. So, what is the data on treating hypertension in hemodialysis patients? Well, there are very few randomized controlled trials. Lowering blood pressure per se has not been shown to improve outcome. I mean, we looked at associations, not obviously specific treatments. There are some studies that show that maybe RAS blockers help. The studies are small. They're underpowered. And again, what's really important, what else can we really do? Again, the studies are really limited. There's, one here with ACE inhibitors, which was kind of sort of helpful, and ARBs. There's another one with beta blockers. I don't think we'll disagree that in people with a lot of heart failure risk, and these people certainly do, that may be a helpful strategy. But, we don't have any long-term outcome trials. And, so what I'd really provide you with more, again, to emphasize the lack of benefit of blood pressure and more the focus on what does make a difference, is let's just look at salt restriction, blood pressure meds, LVH, and hemodialysis patients. Now, this is a very nice little study. Again, what you're doing is comparing people with salt restriction in blue versus those with no salt restriction. And again, if you'll notice, salt restriction, left ventricular hypertrophy. Okay. Look here. Not much of a difference here in blood pressure. Again, look here at interdialytic weight gain and look at the medications. But notice no difference in blood pressure, but a whole lot less of all these bad things here. So, again, maybe dietary salt is the consideration here we need to focus on. And the reality is, obviously, this is hard to do, and is it really enough? So I would also speak a little bit about some of the available data with the sodium gradient. Again, you know, the higher the gradient, it appears, the greater the thirst, the greater the volume overload, and obviously that's a concern we've already discussed at great length. So maybe what we need to do is to figure out ways of avoiding positive sodium chloride balance during hemodialysis. Again, I've already touched on being very cautious about how we model our patients, avoiding hypertonic saline if they drop their pressure, and obviously looking at that delta between the dialysis sodium and what the patient's serum sodium is. And again, a lot of people don't think about that, but I think they're important issues. There have been some studies to look at blood pressure and salt and hemodialysis. I love the acronym. Even nephrologists now are starting to catch up with the cardiologists. But you can see what they did here. They had a control group. They had a group with dietary sodium reduction alone, dialysis sodium reduction, and then obviously doing both. And the conclusions of this trial is that reduction in both dietary and intradialytic sodium influx led to less dry weight gain, improved blood pressure stability, and less antihypertensive medication use. So again, more and more information, if you look at the data, that it's control of volume, salt, and not necessarily the blood pressure. I rest my case. And so what I would say in summary is that volume control is the name of the game. Get to the dry weight. You can look at the blood pressure, play the games, whatever you want to, but I think here are the thoughts. This is what you want to focus on up here. Here are the strategies of the future. Maybe rate control will prove to be important. Obviously, issues surrounding other structural therapeutic strategies may be important. But Dr. Agarwal, I'm not talking about blood pressure here. I don't see anything about blood pressure here. Does anyone see anything about blood pressure here? I don't think so. So anyway, I rest my case.
Very good. Matt, come to the right. Have a seat. Dr. Agarwal, you want to come up here, please? These two excellent discussions are open for questions and answers by you, or questions by you and answers by them. I'll take the liberty of posing the first. There have been several mentions of transthoracic impedance measurement for volume. Any good or not?
I don't think there are enough data to support the use of it. There are small studies, and we don't really know if it is good.
Okay. Matt, do you have a similar opinion?
I would defer to Rajiv. Obviously, he is the ultimate scientist in this regard. I have been underwhelmed, and of course, you know, much of my discussions even with him about how to look at new diagnostic possibilities for looking at central and pressure volume overload, because to be very honest with you, and again, I discussed this with Dr. Sinha earlier today on the podium in the earlier message after his presentation, maybe how we can more objectively determine volume in late CKD 4 and 5 as they evolve into renal replacement therapy may be one of the most critical factors. We've used the blood pressure, we've used the neck veins, we've used all the techniques that he so nicely discussed, but we really need something more objective, because that may be really the step in the right direction to really reduce the risk with all the heart failure and arrhythmia that we see.
Good. Questions? Step to the microphone, please.
Thanks. John DeGiris from Chicago. This is a question both to either to Rajiv or Matt. Obviously, control of blood pressure is important, control of volume is important. I think one possible difficulty may come up with the idea of titrating volume control based upon blood pressure. Because obviously, volume control is a U-shaped curve. If you dry patients out too much, there's enhanced risks. There's sort of this unspoken idea that all we need in dialysis patients is to dry them out. And if we dry them out sufficiently, they won't require any more antihypertensive medicine, so they'll require very few. However, if we take somebody with a GFR of 30 to 40, we find out that to control their blood pressure, they need three antihypertensive medications. You can't just control their blood pressure by giving them Lasix. In fact, if you start giving a patient like that a lot of Lasix, what starts to happen is the creatinine goes up, and the creatinine may be the canary in the coal mine, suggesting this hypoperfusion of the kidney, but there may well be hypoperfusion of other organs, especially the gut, the brain, the heart. So I think that there's a great risk to volume reduction, and the idea that we can totally control blood pressure by just reducing volume may be wrong, and if we try and push volume reduction with more powerful techniques until we normalize the blood pressure, we may be drying out the patient too much and reducing critical perfusion to critical organs. That's my concern.
Well, I would use your question, which I think is a great one, and ask Rajiv, because he's the scientist. One of the things that has really struck me clinically is the substantial amount of pulmonary hypertension that our patients with chronic kidney disease have. And I see it even in kidney transplant patients, where after they've had restitution of normal renal function, they still have recurrent problems with heart failure due to pulmonary hypertension. And, you know, part of the problem with pulmonary hypertension is that you go after them and try to dry them out, and you have that impaired transfer of volume from the right to the left side, which I think is obviously further aggravated under those circumstances. So, you know, the real question is, might there be therapeutic strategies to deal with those patients, which is a little bit different? And often they're not diagnosed, and they really present what I would describe as a major clinical conundrum in my practice, and I'm sure yours. Rajiv, do you have some thoughts?
So, John, you raise a very important point, is that, you know, somebody who is in stage 5 CKD needs 4 or 5 antihypertensive drugs, and now you're talking about being on dialysis, and you just remove volume, and they become normotensive. Is that really fair? And I think the volume control is a complicated issue in these patients. The patients who have the toughest time achieving normal blood pressures are those who cut their dialysis times. And they often, you will find, on average, people dialyze 3.5 hours. Not when you prescribe 4-hour dialysis, they are not getting the 4 hours. They sometimes will skip dialysis, they will cut dialysis short, and sometimes, you know, there are other factors. So if the key is to give them the duration of dialysis and also perform adequate sodium subtraction, if you will. And those strategies, you know, if you look around the world in Tassin in France, where they dialyze for long hours, they give low sodium diet, and they achieve that blood pressure, those people have the best outcomes. So like you pointed out, I don't think that the dry them out till they crash and burn, that's not the strategy that I would advocate. I think it's going to be a cautious strategy where you cannot let the patient and ignore the hypoperfusive symptoms while they are getting hypotensive.
Yes, Alfred.
Yes, sir. Rice in New Orleans. In non-end-stage renal disease patients, to decrease sodium intake or to decrease volume is also very important in order to decrease blood pressure. But I didn't hear that you have mentioned decreasing weight. What do you think about the weight reduction in end-stage renal disease patients relating with the blood pressure?
Well, I would just say this. You know, as you know, Efren, part of the concern we have in people on dialysis is malnutrition, and that obviously there is an inverse relationship between serum albumin and survival. So, you know, many people lose weight, dry weight, and unfortunately that leads to more volume overload because their dialysis prescription is not necessarily adjusted. But as I mean, I suspect what you're saying is adiposity contributing to, you know, the problem of the blood pressure. You know, paradoxically, the more overweight you are, the better off you are as a dialysis patient.
Other questions? Efren, did you have it? Okay.
Aldo Peixoto, New Haven. So Matt, one thing just to add to what Rajiv just said about duration of dialysis, and I'm not sure with whom of you I agree, but one issue that I thought was very interesting related to bringing down volume only is that, number one, in the DRIP study, in which I don't think you can do any better with volume reduction with standard hemodialysis, a substantial number of patients remained hypertensive. Second, if you look at the Sun, they published a paper in collaboration with the Karolinska group about 10 years ago that I thought was very interesting. You look at the Tassan group, everybody normotensive, about a quarter of patients with above normalized extracellular fluid volume based on bioimpedance. When you look at the Karolinska group, you have a group of on standard hemodialysis, hypertensive, a very large number with expanded extracellular fluid volume. And then when you take the standard hemodialysis with normal blood pressure, still some people above. So it's not only being euvolemic, but at least by objective measures. There's something more, and there's something more especially to longer dialysis. And I think that that's, you know, obviously the frequent dialysis study didn't answer that. It wasn't powered to answer that. It was a missed opportunity. Nothing similar is going to get funded. But there's something different about keeping people on the machine for longer periods of time, and I think that this is based on available data, at least on case series, and certainly on personal experience.
So Aldo, I think you make a good point that, you know, the duration of dialysis may have an effect that is independent of volume control in these patients. And I don't think we have solved that, and we certainly need to pay attention to the people who are not being controlled in your dialysis unit. Go and look at their run records, and you'll find that they're often getting 3-hour dialysis or 3.5-hour dialysis, and they might have a catheter that is running reversed, or they might have an access malfunction. I think these things are interconnected. You know, the efficiency of dialysis, the duration of dialysis, the sodium prescription, and ultimately it's reflected in volume and blood pressure. And to reiterate your point, when you can certainly have patients who are remarkably volume overloaded and they are normotensive. And those are probably your most dangerous patients, because when they come in with normal blood pressure, those are the ones who don't get ultrafiltered, because the nursing staff says, well, they have a pressure of 100, how can I remove weight? Well, they gain 4 kilos between dialysis treatments. Why aren't you removing weight? Well, the pressure is 100. And those people go through a vicious cycle where they would have more and more volume overload. So, and that's a dangerous group of patients to deal with. So thanks for your comments.
Just wanted to bring up two more points. So if you talk to the people in Tassan, like Chazot, and you ask them about residual renal function, one thing they'll tell you is within 2 or 3 weeks of going on this long, extensive, more extended dialysis regimen with sodium control and volume control, the urine output falls to zero. And they accept it. They say, look, I think that's the price you have to pay, is losing residual renal function. But one thing you should realize is that if you're doing an aggressive volume control strategy, and it's a question now whether this applies to different frequencies of dialysis, there is a risk of losing residual renal function. It's a factor that with residual renal function, you have much less left ventricular hypertrophy, you have much improved survival, you have much improved phosphorus balance, you have all those things that are better for you that you can kill very easily by aggressively, just like you can kill a kidney in somebody with a GFR of 30, you give them too much Lasix and the creatinine is going to double. You can do the same thing. So I think we should just know about this. The other thing is, what about these renal denervation gizmos now? Okay, they zap the kidney, they stop this sympathetic drive from the kidney, the blood pressure goes down. Now this patient's on dialysis, the same patient, the blood pressure is high. Did that sympathetic drive disappear? All I'm trying to say is hypertension is a multifactorial disease, and it's mostly volume, but I really don't, I think it's simplistic to think that it's completely volume, and I just would really like to individualize our therapy. And sometimes if the blood pressure doesn't go down, to think that maybe they do need antihypertensive medicines and look for other causes.
So I think that you make an important point that we should individualize therapy, and I don't disagree with that. But to say that these patients lose their residual renal function and therefore we shouldn't ultrafilter them, I think it's a big mistake. Remember, the relationship with the residual renal function and outcomes is an association. And even if you look at the Tassin experience, the 10-year survival rate in Tassin is 89%. It's highest of anywhere in the world. And they lose their, like you pointed out, you know, they lose their renal residual renal function in 3 weeks or whatever you said, six months. You have talked to the person that who does it. So a cause and effect relationship between residual renal function and outcomes shouldn't be taken as evidence that we shouldn't do it in these individuals. We have to individualize therapy, and I'm not advocating that ultrafilter them then till they pass out or they die. We have to consider that these people have a multifactorial etiology and other systems are clearly important. In fact, today in the Met page, there was a report of kidney zap and improvement in blood pressure in CKD. It was presented at a European conference, and they had remarkable improvements in blood pressure. Clearly, sympathetic activation is important, and it would be important to treat them in a multifactorial way.
Okay. I have an obligation to end on time. We did start on time. You've been treated to two superb discussions, some great questions. As chair, I get to be judge and jury, and I declare you, the members of the audience, the winners in this excellent discussion. Thank you very much.